This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Basically, what that's going to mean in practice is better law enforcement, more engagement with online marketplaces, and an opportunity to discuss changing the law and strengthening the law so it can really target wildlife cyber criminals.
That's Tanya McRae Steele from the Global Wildlife Project Lead at the International Fund for Animal Welfare. Details coming up.
Also, Somalia demands an explanation of a U.S. airstrike it claims killed 13 security forces. And opposition groups are still boycotting talks in the DRC, saying President Joseph Kabila is trying to delay elections.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on African News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, human rights organizations in Kenya have raised questions over the killings of three girls earlier this month at a police station in Mombasa. Police said the girls were Islamic State terrorists who attacked the station, but human rights organizations say the story is a cover-up for police abuses. The findings have prompted an investigation by the police oversight authority. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
At around 10 a.m. on the morning of September 11th, gunfire erupted inside a police station in the coastal city of Mombasa. 3 hours later, three girls, two of them sisters, were dead. Police say the girls attacked the officers with a knife, suicide vest and fuel bomb, and that in the process one officer was injured. Days later, a video emerged showing the unfolding events in the police compound. The video begins with one of the girls writhing in pain, followed by seven gunshots. Muslims for Human Rights chairperson Khalif Khalifa says the girls did not pose a threat to the officers and should have been arrested instead.
In the video, it shows very clearly that one of the ladies was alive. And there were two officers in turns, they were shooting at her. Several bullets. And to us, that was wrong, because they could have arrested these girls, take them to court, but they didn't. And the other video with images inside the police station, she was still alive till about 1:45, and the incident happened around 10 o'clock.
Police spokesman Charles Owino voiced disagreement.
Dead people don't tell tales. But if the situation is such that there's no alternative but to have them die in order to protect the majority of the people, then it happens. But it happens with a very heavy heart. It happens without us having intentions to particularly have them dead. We would want every suspect to be caught alive.
Authorities investigating the case say the girls had links to Islamic State. Kenyan media report a post-mortem examination revealed two of the girls died from bullet wounds in the head and chest, while the third girl died from burns. Khalifa says the father of two of the girls testified that he wouldn't hold anyone responsible for their deaths.
This old man, we met him at the mortuary, so we demand there must be a proper autopsy. He came with an affidavit signed by a lawyer that he doesn't want autopsy to be done because he's a Muslim. But when you read that affidavit, he said he's absolving police with any blame. You see? And to us, that was made by duress. He was forced to do that. You see, people are scared. Even if the parents doesn't want, the human rights organization will take it forward as we are doing it now.
Independent Police Oversight Authority spokesman Dennis Okech tells VOA the investigation has begun so authorities can establish what may have happened.
We have since deployed a rapid response team from our investigations directorate who are on the ground following up on that with a view of establishing what exactly happened in this case and if the police were justified in using the force that they used. And if there is any logical alternative means they would have used.
In February, two police officers were convicted and handed 7-year prison sentences for killing a teenage girl in Kwale County in 2014. So far, 7 people have been arrested in connection with the alleged attack in Mombasa, including Hania Sagar, the widow of slain radical cleric Abu Drogo. Sagar is alleged to have financed and been in frequent contact with one of the girls. 3 suspects are accused of failing to provide to authorities information that could have thwarted the attack. They have denied the allegations. Kenya has been a target of terror groups for its involving in supporting the Somali government and fighting Islamic State inside Somalia. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Somalia has demanded an explanation of a U.S. airstrike near the town of Galkayo, in which a drone targeted Al-Shabaab fighters on Wednesday. The vice president of Galamadug State, Mohamed Hashi Abdi, told VOA Somali Service 13 security forces died in the drone strike. Abdi says officials in the semi-autonomous Puntland region argue that there is no Al-Shabaab presence in the Galamadug area. The U.S. State Department says in a news release the self-defense strike killed at least 9 militants. Today, the U.S. ambassador to Somalia, Stephen Schwartz, commented on the situation.
It's something that the U.S. government, both the mission in Nairobi and Mogadishu, the State Department, and most particularly the Department of Defense, are taking very, very seriously. Certainly any loss of life by non-combatants is regrettable and unfortunate. The Department of Defense right now isn't convinced that non-combatants were killed. They're looking into it. I know there's a lot of various allegations back and forth. So all I can say is that I don't have the facts. I'm not sure who has the facts right now, but we're looking into it. We're taking it quite seriously. And hopefully we will continue to refine and announce at least what we believe to be the case as we get more information.
Galkayo residents have been protesting against the U.S. strike and burned a U.S. flag yesterday. The U.S. has carried out many airstrikes in Somalia targeting Al-Shabaab members.
Humanitarian workers are trying to deliver food and medical help to more than 2 million Nigerians displaced by the Boko Haram insurgency. But another 6 million farmers and pastoralists also face malnutrition, hunger, and disease in the larger Lake Chad Basin. Drought caused by global warming has added to the region's problems in recent years. International aid agencies are now struggling to reach small communities where large numbers of people have been displaced by drought conditions and the shrinking shores of Lake Chad. The International Committee of the Red Cross reports that thousands of small remote communities in Chad, Cameroon, and Niger, as well as Nigeria's northeast, have experienced 3 years of failed crops. Aid workers are still not able to reach many of the displaced. Access is difficult because of poor roads and the continuing efforts of regional militaries to defeat factions of Boko Haram militants in the region.
Political talks in the Democratic Republic of Congo resumed today after they were suspended last week during deadly protests. Key opposition groups are still boycotting the talks, saying President Joseph Kabila is trying to delay elections so he can stay in office past the end of his second term. William Klaus has the latest from Kinshasa.
At 1 a.m. Friday, weary members of several Congolese opposition parties emerged from a meeting which had lasted almost 12 hours. They said that they had decided to return to a political dialogue, which was suspended early last week after 2 days of deadly protests on the streets of Kinshasa. But it is unclear whether the talks can be productive. A larger coalition of opposition parties, known as the Rassemblement, or the Assembly, still refuses to participate. The highly influential Catholic Church, known as SENCO, has also withdrawn, and said it will only return if the Rassemblement joins the talks. VOA spoke with Stephanie Walters of the Institute for Security Studies Africa about the dialogue's prospects for success.
Without SENCO and without the addition of new opposition parties, the dialogue will lack credibility. There are two very difficult issues that have to be worked out, notably the date of the elections and explicit language in the accord, which is not in there now, about Kabila not standing for another term. If we see an accord signed by the parties that are participating that, for example, doesn't include language about Kabila not standing or puts the date of elections in 2018, we're going to be right back at zero. No one is going to accept that.
The Rassemblement argues that the talks are simply a means for Kabila to delay elections, which were slated for November, and stay in power beyond the constitutionally defined two-term limit. The government says the talks are aimed at reaching an agreement on how the DRC should proceed to credible elections. Vital Kamerhe heads the opposition faction which is taking part. This part of the opposition says Kabila can remain in power, leading an interim government of national unity, until the next presidential election, but insists that he must not stand as a candidate in it. Meanwhile, Congolese authorities appear to be continuing their crackdown on those who participated in the protests September 19th and 20th, during which the UN says more than 50 people were killed. VOA spoke to George Kapiamba, the president of the Congolese Association for Access to Justice. Kapiamba said that more than 1,800 people were arrested throughout the DRC during and after the protests, and that 110 have already been given sentences of between 45 days and 25 years. They have been convicted in trials lasting only 40 minutes, without their or their lawyers having any time to become acquainted with the cases against them, Kapiamba said. He told VOA that at least 34 children have been detained and are being kept in cells with hardened criminals, including murderers. The United States this week's imposed sanctions on two Kabila aides it accuses of repressing human rights and blocking the organization of elections. William Clowes for VOA News, Kinshasa.
Coming up on 17 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Sales of illegal animal products are booming on the internet, but the world's largest convention on wildlife trade hopes to stop that by passing a landmark resolution aimed at the shadowy online market for such items. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Anti-trafficking campaigner Shu Ling offered a macabre list of what her team found in a recent online search for rare and illegal animal products.
We found like tiger bone wine, tiger skin, yeah, and the ivory, the tail, elephant tail, and rhino horn.
That's right, tiger bone wine. That's a potion made by soaking the bones of endangered tigers in rice wine. Its proponents say it boosts sex drive and relieves arthritis. But those claims have no scientific proof. Xu spoke to VOA at this year's meeting of the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. She says the online market in illegal wildlife products is immense, as the internet offers anonymity and can connect buyers and sellers over large distances. Xu works for Traffic, which tracks illegal wildlife trade. She has monitored online retailers in China since 2012. Last year, the organization found that, at the peak of activity, as many as 4,000 new ads for illegal wildlife items were appearing monthly on Chinese websites. This week, CITES members passed a Kenya-led resolution aimed at eliminating that trade. The organization's 183 members agreed to work closely with each other and with national and international law enforcement bodies to fight online trade of wildlife products. They also agreed to explore the idea of funding a full-time position at Interpol, which will focus on wildlife cybercrime. Tanya McRae-Steele, the Global Wildlife Cybercrime Project lead at the International Fund for Animal Welfare, explained the intent of the resolution.
Basically, what that's going to mean in practice is better law enforcement, more engagement with online marketplaces, and an opportunity to discuss changing the law and strengthening the law so it can really target wildlife cybercriminals.
Xu says that law enforcement alone is not enough to fight cybercrime. Traffic last year signed an agreement with Tencent, a massive Chinese internet service company, to work together to combat online trafficking. China's hardline stance against online wildlife trafficking has been successful, she says.
In China, it is very serious to sell the ivory and other endangered species in the online markets as well as in the physical markets. I can give you the one example. This year, just in August, the China Forest Police, they detected a very big online seizure. Confiscated more than 200 kilogram ivory and 17 kilogram rhino horn. Actually, this seizure is detected as a result of joint efforts by Forest Police and Tencent, the social media platform, and Traffic.
But she says Cyber criminals are wily, and every time one internet portal closes, another opens. Since the crackdown in China began, traffic found that sales of illegal wildlife products were moving off e-commerce sites and migrating to social media platforms. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
And on a program note, beginning Monday, October 3rd, VOA Africa in Nairobi will air Daybreak Africa at 0300 and 0500 UTC. VOA's international edition will air at 0400, 0530 and 1900 UTC. And the Sunny Side of Sports will air at 1930 UTC. Tune in, you'll be glad you did.
Groups of violent extremists have expanded their reach into Africa. In one example, the failure of the government in Libya to provide domestic security has allowed the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda to set up operations in the Sahel region. Mohammed El-Shenawi examines the drivers behind the rise in terrorism and measures that could counter it.
A recent study by Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington warns of the growing ties between local groups in Africa and global terror networks. By declaring their allegiance to Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb and Boko Haram have found new ways to receive funds and recruit fighters. Thomas Sanderson, a co-author of the study, explains the reasons behind the rise of violent extremist groups in the Sahel.
I don't think you can underestimate the collapse in Libya and what it's done in terms of bringing weapons down into this region and bringing people to and from the region. The Mali collapse and the coup is absolutely fundamental to leaving the north even more ungoverned and unguarded than it was before. The economic and demographic stresses, don't forget, have the lowest indicators worldwide in terms of economic development and social development, social media awareness. And don't forget that Boko Haram has a relationship with ISIS now. It's been on the social media.
Sanderson argues also that poor and corrupt governance continues to be good motivation for the recruitment of these groups of violent extremists. Criminal groups and others are eager to join the fight for ungoverned spaces in northern Mali to facilitate narcotic trafficking. The study says, as Libya and international forces press against Islamic State and Al-Qaeda strongholds, extremist fighters could quickly flow into the Sahel. They could be emboldened by new weaponry, fighting experience, and new local partners. Benjamin Nichols is associate professor at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies. He says the United States, along with regional and international partners, should not be complacent about extremism and insecurity in the Sahel.
The U.S. should be vigilant because terrorism in the Sahel could become a direct and significant threat for the U.S. and its interests. So the U.S. should work now to do a handful of things. It should support regional cooperation. It should encourage the rule of law and protection of civilians. It should counterbalance military assistance with development aid. And it should promote good governance generally in the Sahel.
Professor Nichols says an effective regional response means that the nations of the Sahel need to overcome their ambivalence toward taking up the counter-terrorism fight. He says they should end their over-reliance on military solutions and their apathy toward making necessary governance reforms. Mohammed El-Shenawi, VOA News, Washington.
With over 12,000 employees, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is one of the largest public health and research agencies in the world. The agency served American needs, but CDC also plays an important role outside the U.S. by advising and supporting other national health systems. In the second part of VOA's Adam Phillips interview with CDC Director Dr. Tom Frieden, Frieden explained the agency's support role.
We don't try to create branches of CDC all over the world. We rather try to help other countries create their own public health institutions with their own staff and laboratories, training and monitoring systems, so that they can be there, they can find out what's happening and address the problems where they're most urgently needed.
Why is it in the CDC's interest? Why are they interested in public health programs in other places? I mean, you know, America's big enough. I mean, we've kind of got ours.
From a plain fact basis, our doctors care deeply about human life, whether it's an American life or a life anywhere. And if we've got a treatment or a vaccine or a prevention that can be applied and it's not being applied, at some level, we feel a culpability for a death that occurs in that situation. In addition, the United States government recognizes that it's in our self-interest to help other countries. It's easier to help another country stop a disease there than to have to worry about possibly having to fight it on our own shores. We're tied together as a world, and if we do better finding and stopping health threats, we'll all be healthier.
Can you give me just a sense, sort of a simple idea of what's involved in creating a modern, effective public health system on a national level?
There is a very clear sense of what you need to do for effective public health action. You have to find threats when they first emerge. You have to stop them rapidly, and you have to prevent them wherever possible. How do you find things? You find things by having doctors report in, laboratories that can diagnose, disease detectives that can analyze the data. We've trained over 3,000 disease detectives, including well over 1,500 in Africa, who now are in country helping those countries figure out what the problems are. In terms of response, we encourage the development of rapid response units and emergency operations centers so that you can find an outbreak and then rapidly respond to it to stop it. That's what was done in Lagos, Nigeria, using the polio infrastructure, and that stopped Ebola from becoming a catastrophe in Nigeria and Africa, even though it was a terrible epidemic in West Africa.
Tell me a little more about how the infrastructure that Nigerian doctors used to fight polio was put at the service of combating Ebola. That's fascinating.
What happened in Lagos, Nigeria, is that when Ebola emerged, when there was a cluster, it was first very difficult for the Nigerian government to deal with it. And then they brought in the polio team, the Nigerian doctors who had learned how to stop polio. They did a terrific job. They found the contacts. They traced them. They built an Ebola treatment unit, and they stopped the Ebola outbreak. If that hadn't have happened, it's quite possible that Ebola would still be spreading widely in parts of Africa.
Speaking of polio, I know that 3 new cases of polio have been discovered in Nigeria recently. I realize this was a terrible disappointment since Nigerian health officials and others had thought that polio was on the verge of total eradication in Nigeria.
And that shows us that polio was lurking in parts of the country where there was not a good monitoring system because of anti-government activities and because of the lack of access of healthcare workers to those areas. This shows the importance of disease tracking, of monitoring diseases, what's called disease surveillance, so that we can see where polio may be spreading. There could be parts of DRC, there could be parts of Cameroon or other places where polio is similarly lurking, and therefore we really have to double down on doing a better job tracking polio and making sure that we get rid of it once and for all from Africa.
It sounds like there's sort of an international fellowship of health professionals that really knows no boundaries. Is that true?
There is absolutely the observation that health can be a bridge. Even when there are strong disagreements between countries, we should be able to agree that it's in all of our interest for people to avoid preventable illness, that we don't want diseases spreading from one country to another, and that we all can learn something from each other.
That was Dr. Tom Frieden, director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to The Sunny Side of Sports, coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
voaafrica.com.
On voaafrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOA